Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Austin East Ciders. For more information, visit their website at austineastciders.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening, and welcome to
Foment About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. It has been an awesome and fun week. And
yeah. We're back. This is our first time.
Yes.
It's my first time back for fall season because I was in San Francisco for work last week.
Yeah, thanks for holding down the fort last week, Chris. Yeah,
no problem. Thanks for those interviews you guys took at Boston Ferments.
We do have a couple interviews left, so we will air those soon in the upcoming future.
Season.
Yeah. I will say, so San Francisco, I was at a work meeting. I did not get to go to any breweries or anything like that, but I did get to have a couple of local beers. So I got to give a shout out. I had a Magnolia California Kolsch from Magnolia Brewing Company, a really lovely salted cucumber beer from Fieldwork Brewing Company, which is a newer brewery in Berkeley. And of course, I had the obligatory Russian River Pliny the Elder, which was delicious as I remembered. All right, so we've had an action-packed couple of weekends before and after my trip to San Francisco. So I got to give a shout out. We headed to Captain Lawrence Brewing Company, which is here in Elmhurst, New York. Elmhurst is right?
I believe so.
I always get that mixed up.
It is a place.
Yeah. That was the Saturday before last. They had their Soured in September festival, and Chris and I drank some really excellent sour beers, both made locally and from all over the place. So kudos. It was hot as hell. It was 96 degree heat index.
Great day for sour beer.
Yeah, but there was plenty of shade, and I got to give kudos to the Captain Lawrence crew. They had a ton. They had hand pump kegs of water in all over the place. So it was great. Basically drank a sample glass full of water between every beer sample, and I survived pretty well. But that's always good to see a ton of water available at a brew fest.
Damn straight.
Let's talk about what we did this weekend. Our friend John and Jess here in Greenpoint neighborhood of Brooklyn grew a massive Cascade hop plant in their backyard. So this is a Brooklyn Cascade hop. And it was so big that they invited a bunch of people over for a barbecue and hop harvesting party. So we were there on Saturday. Yeah, Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And we harvested 11 pounds of fresh wet hops.
From the backyard in Brooklyn.
Yes.
To Greenpoint, I mean. Greenpoint.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome.
Greenpoint,
so they vacuum sealed everything, and we brought home 3 bags with us, put them in the freezer for use to be determined.
They were half-pound bags, so, you know, it was great.
Yeah.
I'm responding to charades in the room.
All right. Recently, I was over at another friend's house. We had watermelon during the day. So I took the rind home with me, and I had never made pickled watermelon rind, but I decided to try it, and it was very successful.
I shouted that out last week, by the way.
We
were inspired by Jeff on that from the gefilte doc.
Yeah,
Jeffrey.
I also I found a recipe on a blog called Lisa's Counter Culture, so I kind of based it around that. So I did a 1 gallon batch, and I made about a half a gallon brine that covered that covered all the watermelon I had in a 1 gallon jar. So I used about 40 grams of sea salt, 3 cloves of garlic, a tablespoon of fresh grated ginger, around a teaspoon of mixed peppercorns, and 3 dried dundi cut peppers. That's a Pakistani pepper that's really nice. And it turned out really well. And it turns out that that brine is excellent for picklebacks. So we brought some
pickled watermelon picklebacks.
So we had
after day harvesting hops.
Exactly. We had some picklebacks with the pickled watermelon brine after hop harvesting on Saturday, and it was delicious. Sunday morning, we did a charity walk in the Bronx, the New York Botanic Garden in the Bronx, and I realized that we were super close to Yonkers Brewing Company, which is a brew pub brewery in Yonkers, New York. That's not technically New York City, but it is a very short train ride. They are right by the station. So they have food. We had brunch and beers, and it was excellent.
It was awesome.
We've been wanting to get up there for a long time, but I would say if you're headed to New York City, that is definitely worth a trip.
Short rib eggs Benedict was crushing.
Yep.
Crushing.
That's true. And they had what was my favorite beer? The Rauchweizen.
You had the Rauchweizen, yeah.
Yeah, which is really lovely.
That was beautiful.
And then last night, we headed over to Rockaway Brew Co.
But after that, we went to the LIC Flea for the Asian Food Festival put on by Joe DiStefano. And that was worth noting because he does a lot of really fun food festivals in all of Queens and celebrates.
He is a Queens food expert. We're going to have him on later this season. He's doing a cheese fest event in Queens, I think in December. So we're going to have him on before that to talk about all kinds of fermented food that he finds in Queens, and also about his event. So look for that in like probably November. Okay, so last night we headed to Rockaway Brew Co. Flint, who is in charge of the tasting room over there, is a great guy. We had him on our Pruno show recently. He did a mead tasting. So he partnered up with Rob DeShack of Skyline Honey, who is a local home beekeeper. I think he has hives on the Lower East Side here in Manhattan. And Flint made 7 different meads or variations of mead, and we got to taste them. It was an awesome event. It was in their Rockaway's upstairs private space, and he had a variety of stuff, including two braggots, including a sour stout, as well as a variety of other sizers and meads. And anyway, it was a lot of fun and some really good stuff.
Complete with Viking horns to drink.
Yes, exactly. Last but not least, I am doing a cider class. It was originally scheduled for this Wednesday at Bitter and Esther's. We have changed that to next Wednesday on the 28th. It is $50. I'm going to teach how to make cider, all kinds of ciders. We'll talk about how to judge and evaluate your cider, how to source juices, choose your yeast, etc. I have made 4 ciders to pour, and then I will also be pouring several of Descendant ciders from Jaheel Maplestone and Crew, which is a Queens cidery.
Speaking of events, I've got 3, and we're going to do it real quick so we can get into our show. This Wednesday on the 22nd, Brewmosity is happening at Littlefield in Brooklyn, and it's an evening of craft beer tasting for the benefit of Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. So enjoy the artisanry of 36 different home brewers hailing from clubs across the greater New York area. Admission includes unlimited beer, open bar for alternative refreshments. The brewers will compete for the different prizes. It's going to be a really great time. It's for a great cause. You can go to littlefieldnyc.com to check that out. Next up, Pour Mania on Saturday, October 1st from 1 to 5 p.m. on Staten Island, a flagship brewery. It is another, it's Pour Standards Homebrew Club. It's the third one of its time. Last year was a blast. This year's going to be great. It is also a charity, and it basically, 25% of this is going to SICAW, which is Staten Island Animal Rescue Organization. And it's $25 includes, or $25 early bird, $30 as we get closer. That's October 1st. The Home Brewsicians will be playing. We'll be playing a set in there along with a couple other bands, so we're really looking forward to it. We don't take ourselves very seriously at all, and it's a lot of fun. Then, speaking of animals, we have Beer for Beasts happening on October 15th, put on by Six Point, and that is going to be at the Bell House. A lot of different collaborations are happening there, and that is also to benefit and rescued animals and battered animals, abused animals. So check that out. You can go to beerforbeasts.com.
All right. And while you guys were trekking around New York last week, I was trekking around Philadelphia, and I managed to get in a couple of beers while I was there. So I went to check out Philadelphia's Barcade in Fishtown, and I had an, I think it was Oscar Blues Burrito, because I liked the name a lot, so shout out to them. And I got to the Philadelphia Honey Festival, and they were pouring some, not meads, but beers brewed with honey. So I had some from the St. Benjamin's Brewery and some from the Philly Homebrew Outlet, who did a collaboration. And then I also got to go to the Dock Street Brewery, which was around the corner from my friend in West Philadelphia. And they were really nice. They had born something on tap. She was not born and raised in West Philadelphia. But they had something on tap called, called Friends Don't Let Friends Vote Drumpf, Man Full of Promises Stout. Well done. Well done. And we just had to order that because the description was really silly. So that's what I had in Philadelphia. For events, next week I'm actually teaching a kombucha workshop on the 27th at 7 p.m. at the Park Slope Moshe House. And when I find out where that is, I will let you know.
How do we find out more information about that? To come,
so there should be a Facebook event, and I guess you just will search kombucha workshop Moshe House. That's M-O-I-S-H-E House.
Moshe.
Moshe House.
Moshe.
Yeah,
love
exactly.
It. Fantastic. I don't know, maybe, geez, really long time ago, we were hanging out and tasting a lot of homebrews from around this town. There are a lot of young bucks up and coming. Mary and I were deeply involved with the New York City Homebrewers Guild, still are. We were starting to host events with Get Real Presents, doing events around the thing. I think that our guest, the first time I met him, I think we met maybe at Brooklyn Homebrews, first Brooklyn Wort.
And I met our guest at a Brooklyn Rot meeting at the Old Beer.
Wow.
Back was around.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is the voice of Jesse Ferguson, now of Interborough Spirits and Ales. Jesse, welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's fun.
It has been a fun ride watching your growth and development. This is Beer Is Not Your First Life. Let's start at the beginning, man, real quick. What did you do before? Because there's a connection that we have from your previous life that now it's all coming full circle. It's fun.
Well, I was born. And then...
It's your mom. Yeah, that's it. That's the connection. Hey.
So thank you for having me, guys. I'm really excited to be here and to talk about Interborough and everything that's gotten me to Interborough, brewing in Brooklyn, back to brewing in Brooklyn. So my previous job was I helped start and found Def Jux Records in 2000 or 1999, I suppose. And I was DJing, and that led me to meet a lot of people, one of whom is Bisque One, mm-hmm. who recently did a bunch of really incredible art on the walls at Interborough. And you and Bisque used to... do freestyle sessions
Mondays,
together.
Freestyle Mondays. Yeah, man.
And what was the name of the spot?
We went through a couple different places, but it started at Sin Sin Fifth Street and Second Avenue.
Yeah, Sin Sin.
Back in the day, yep.
So I spent from 2000 to 2009 helping to produce and sell and work with the artists on Def Jux. And then that was pretty awesome, because at first we had a lot of really incredible records. We always had incredible records, but at first we had incredible records that sold really well because people still bought
CDs.
Still
bought records. Oh,
and then around 2005, people just quit buying CDs. And so then the label went out of business, unfortunately, in 2009. And at that point, I had a 9-month-old son, and I'd been homebrewing for... maybe a year or two at that point, probably a year. At that point, my buddy Chris and I had built a cooled fermentation chamber in our basement that could hold 8 carboys. And so we were doing temperature controlled fermentation on a brew a week, basically, or more if we could. I've got family that works in a brewery. I worked at a brewery at the time down at Terrapin in Georgia. My sister and my brother-in-law. My sister still works at Terrapin. My brother-in-law now works at Creature Comforts. And I asked them when Jux was like, because I was pretty involved, so I knew we were going to go out of business. I was looking at the books like, we're going to run out of money. There's a problem here, and you're not going to be able to pay me anymore. Right. And so I asked them, like, hey, what would it take to get into the brewing business? And they said, it's impossible. Everybody wants to be a brewer. Nobody will just give you a job. And I met with Shane. I knew Shane Welch pretty well at that point, at Six Point, because of some collaborations we had done through music and beer. Mm-hmm. Granddad's Nerve Tonic. Shout out to Junk Science and Beercraft. And Shane was like, I'll introduce you. He's like, I don't hire the brewers here. Craig and Evan hire the brewers here, and they've got a list of people to become brewers, but I'll introduce you to Mike Lavolo at Union, and maybe you can go learn how to work in distribution. And Mike Lavolo, shout out, actually got me an interview at Union at that point, and they went in and they offered me a job merchandising in South Brooklyn at grocery stores.
Okay.
And I said, you guys have a car? No, I can't do that. but then a buddy of mine got me a job at another record label, and I made it through a year, at which point Augie Carton, who is a friend of my wife's husband, who they've known each other forever, and I had been, he and I had known each other since 2000, or yeah, right around 2001. We would go down to New Jersey and I'd bring bottles of homebrew, and then I'd bring kegs of homebrew, and then we'd go to his cousin's house, Chris, and they decided that they were going to open a brewery in New Jersey, and I was going to be the brewer. And my reaction was, sure, do that. Let's do that. And the way Augie tells the story to this day is that he had to convince me to be a brewer. And it did take a lot of convincing, because it meant I had to completely rearrange my life when I had a young child, and it was a big decision. But it was thrilling. And we opened Carton in 2011. And right away started selling a lot of Boat and 077. And after 6 months, we were in New York, and then we were selling Boat in 077 in New York. And I was getting a drink Boat in Brooklyn, where I still lived. And it was awesome. And yeah, I mean,
and that was a good ride.
And then after about 4 years, my wife and I decided that there was no way we were going to move to New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And at that point, commuting 3 hours a day for the rest of my life wasn't going to be an option,
right,
at all. And I started to try and figure out what the next steps for me were going to be. And I, through my wife's nephew, who's older than us because it's my wife's half sister, it's more complicated. met Laura Dirks, and she was interested in opening a distillery, and we met and we started talking about distilling, which I knew virtually nothing about, and the similarities between distilling and what we discovered was that, you know, there's beer and then there's whiskey, and you make one in order to make the other. And we started to look at equipment and redundancy and the capabilities of building a facility where we both brew and distill. And she had a lawyer who she was in contact with who was able to sort of pre-flight with the TTB whether it would be feasible to build a facility with the two. And that lawyer came back and said, there's no problem with the TTV as long as you can pay your taxes on time. So then we really started to started kind of think about it seriously. And I went ahead and quit Carton, which was hard because I really enjoyed it there.
Sure.
In December of 15?
14.
14, yes, 14.
Yep. December 14.
And then Sam and Matt, and I quit, and I told Sam and Matt first.
Other half.
Yeah. So the night the threes at least opened as far as I was concerned, because the first time anybody had ever invited me there.
Right.
There were a lot of people there, and they'd probably all been there before, but it was just when they told me. And I was, it was a big decision, and I was happy that I had made the decision. So I told Sam and Matt, and Jeff O'Neill, and they were like, so what are you going to do? And I'm like, well, I'm going to open a brewery. And they're like, what are you really going to do? So then Sam and Matt offered me a job brewing at Other Half, and I started there in March or late February or something like that. And they were cool. They were awesome. They knew I was going to try and start a brewery, and they figured it would take me longer than it did. But they were super supportive, and they still are. And around July, we found the space, and then everything sort of tumbled in after that. And I left Other Half in December of last year, and then we opened in August. So that's the short version.
Sure, no, that's a perfect version. We're gonna take a really quick break, and then we're gonna talk all about now what's happening at Interbro and where you know.
Cool.
Future. Thank now you. And future. You're the best, dude. Thanks. Come on about.
Are you an East Sider? We live on the east side of town. Our shipping container studios are at Roberta and Bushwick, across the East River, separating New York City and Brooklyn. In all my recent travels, it seems like the east side of town is the cool side of town in cities across the country. East Nashville is full of musicians and weird bars. The up-and-coming neighborhood around 8th Street in D.C., on the east side, is overflowing with exciting food and nightlife. The best hidden spots and funky artists in New Orleans are in the Marinian Bywater, which, yup, is the east side of town. So, as East Siders, we love drinks that represent our values. And nothing is more fitting than a cool, refreshing can of Austin East Siders. That's East Cider with a C. As the name implies, it is cider, and it's handmade on, you guessed it, the east side of Austin, Texas, using bittersweet and bittersharp cider apples. Cider apples are full of tannins, adding astringency and complexity of flavor to every sip. Austin East Ciders uses a mixture of European and Pacific Northwest apples to achieve ultimate flavor. Austin East Ciders is available in a few different variations, including original flavor, Texas honey, and two new additions, hopped and pineapple. Here at Heritage Radio, we love Austin East Ciders with some ribs, pulled pork, and even pizza. Especially Roberta's Pizza. You can find out more at AustinEastSiders.com and remember to hashtag EastSiders to show your East Side pride. You can also find Austin East Siders on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Welcome back to Foment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We are here in the studio with Jesse Ferguson of Interboro Spirits and Ales, New York City's newest brewery
and distillery. Well,
this
and only
date,
New York City's
September
only
19th.
Combined yeah, we're the only New York City brewery and distillery.
Yeah, so tell us about that licensing. How did that even come about, and what made you decide to do that?
As I alluded to, my partner, Laura, you know, was interested in whiskey and you know, in craft distilling in general. And so we sort of discovered that, you know, we could do it by working with a lawyer who was able to talk to the TTB and clarify that, yes, you can, in fact, run both facilities in the same facility or both licenses, really, as it were, a distilled spirit permit and a brewer's permit from the federal government. And then New York State, we're lucky, New York State has some of the most progressive laws in the country. And so New York State was also, you know, amenable to both of the permits existing in the same facility as well.
And you actually have four licenses.
Yes, that's true. So the four licenses you have.
Right. So we have a micro distiller and a farm distiller, and we have a micro brewer and a farm brewer. We actually have a fifth license, which is pending the final DOB work, which will be a full on premise. So we actually have five licenses with the SLA, two permits with the federal government. It definitely complicated things in terms of getting getting approval from the feds. Once we, your packet sits on somebody's desk for a long time, like they have a guaranteed window that they'll, you know, address your application within. And for the most part, I don't know, just an estimate, 95% of that time is it's just sitting on somebody's desk. And then they finally look at it, and then they basically just, you've got 2 weeks to get it done, or you've got 2 weeks to respond. And then every time you respond, the amount of time you have to respond gets lesser and lesser. So right. It was like, okay, here's our issues. And it was a laundry list of issues, and Laura and our lawyer sort of addressed them. And then it was like, okay, here's our new issues. And now instead of 14 days to respond, you have 2 days to respond. And so it gets it, but it's great because at that point in the process, you're all, you know, as a small business, you know, owner or soon to be small business owner, all you are is waiting, right, for everybody to finish their jobs. And that one is the one that you have to wait on the federal government for. And when the New York State had already gotten back to us months before saying, we'll approve this. And that was a huge day for us too, just because going into this whole thing, it was like, yeah, right. They're going to say, yeah, sure they are. Like, I was just waiting for them to come back and be like, who do you think you are? Like,
why you and nobody else?
Why do you think you can do this? But they didn't, right? New York State came back and said, okay, just the feds have to sign off now. Cause they rely on each other in a lot of ways. Yeah. Right. So they came back and said that we could. And so then it was like, all right. And then I was just like, all right, the other shoe to drop, right? Like the feds, like, what do you think you're doing? You can't make these things. And what it came down to was a lot of, I mean, what it is it's an alternating premise, right? So all of our equipment alternates except the still and the finished goods storage for the still and a couple things that we've designated as beer or brewery only. So the cold room, because the still spirits will never need to go in the cold room. And then some packaging areas that are brewery only. So, but the rest of the equipment, the mash tun, the hot liquor tank, the kettle, all of the fermenters, even the Bright are considered alternating use. So they could be used for brewery on one day or a distillery on the other day. So because the process for us is to make beer, you know, we start out making beer, we don't hop it, and then we ferment it with brewer's yeast. And then charge the still with it and boil the alcohol off. So the only point at which the product becomes distillery only is when it goes into the still.
Right.
And then it comes out.
And speaking of the beer that you make, you just poured us a really freaking delicious beer called Halftime, right? Tell us about this beer.
Yeah, tell us about this beer.
So Halftime is a malt bill of Czech pills and German Vienna malt. Just a touch of Vienna, not a lot. It's primarily Pilsner.
Thank you for that.
And it's hopped with Cascade and Galaxy in the kettle, all late additions, and then it was dry hopped with Citra.
All late additions, like starting at 10?
I believe it was Cascade at 10 and Galaxy at Whirlpool.
Cool. Yeah, no, it's delicious.
Thank you.
Forward.
Yeah. It's 4% alcohol.
4% crushable.
Yeah. So it's 10 Play-Doh starting gravity, and it finished under 2. Mm-hmm. I can't remember exactly where.
So you've been making beer for a very long time. How have you researched on the distilling part? I mean, which certainly is. And I don't know how many friends you've had prior to Laura in the distilling community. In beer, we're very open with our knowledge and sharing.
Yeah.
What are you finding?
When Laura and I first met, we were working with a gentleman who had been an assistant distiller. So mm-hmm. He was interested in getting involved, and then decided he couldn't be involved. And so he really helped. He really helped me sort of make the connection between with the equipment and the steps in the equipment. I attended a crash course on mm-hmm. distilling in Kentucky called Moonshine University. And it was,
name. I didn't know his name. That.
Yeah. but it was awesome. I mean, they had really good people there. They had like the barrel master from Brown-Forman came and taught us about, you know, or did a 2 hours about, you know, about barrel selection and barrel aging, and the distiller, the head distiller from Corsair, was there to do a whole 2 hour or longer presentation about gin. We actually made gin on bench stills. There was a gentleman there who, you know, basically spent 3 or 4 hours telling us about rum and walking us through rum production. And then they had an actual, like, 240 gallon still and mash cooker there. So we did a mash, we did a corn mash, some pretty incredible stuff. Like, they would, you know, we put in however many 100 pounds of corn, ground corn, cornmeal, brought it to boil, and then dropped the temperature to saccharification to add the malt. And, you know how you can hear a pump working, or a motor working rather, like, yeah. So it's spinning the whole time because it's boiling corn, right? And you can't let it stick to the sides of the kettle. And it's for a while, right? They got to get it up to boil, and then they keep it there for a certain amount of time to gelatinize it and free up the sugars, break down all the proteins, and then they start cooling it, right? And they're cooling with water. They had a water tower is how they cooled, rather an air cooled water tower, rather, and they had a glycol system as well, but they didn't use the glycol to chill the water per se. They used the glycol for the condenser water, but not for the kettle water, I believe, or the cooker water. So it took a while to cool down.
So the cooker just jacketed then?
It's jacketed, it's steamed. So their cooker steam jacketed. Well, honestly, in Kentucky distilling, they intend, most places with the cookers actually just blow steam in, right? They just, the steam supply just goes straight into the mash.
To the mash itself?
Yeah. And that's how they heat it up. And then it's jacketed to cool it down.
Okay.
So they're really concerned about the cleanliness of their steam on some level, right? But so they're cooling down the motor, and then all of a sudden they throw the malt in, right? And all of a sudden it just starts spinning so much faster. Yeah. The conversion happened instantly. It was like they basically put malt powder in. Like distillers will grind. They're grinding to flour, basically. Yeah, they're grinding to flour. Their crush is so much finer than it, because they don't lauter, right? So there's it's just porridge. But the conversion was instant. You know, brewers sit around talking about how, oh, I need a 30-minute rest, I need a 45-minute rest, I need a 90-minute rest. And if with a coarser crush, obviously, there's going to be a longer, you know, there's carbohydrates in the endosperm that they're not going to access as quickly, right? But yeah, this was crazy. I had never seen conversion demonstrated so so clearly and instantly. But yeah, it was, in terms of like distillers that I know, I could count on one hand, honestly. Right. I'm meant to spend the last 2 years making some good friends in the distilling world. And, you know, the guys over in New York Distilling have been super helpful. Folks at Kings County have been helpful when it came to talking about safety was one of the big concerns we had, especially during build out. Because what it came down to was I had questions about really practical stuff when we were actually building. Like, what do we do? You know what I mean? Like, how do we make sure that this is going to be a safe place to work? And so those folks were really helpful.
The stills have like different lighting required. Like, you have to have different kind of lights and stuff, right?
You know, anything that's within, you know, an 8 foot or 12 foot radius, it has to be explosion proof.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Because pure ethyl alcohol has a flash point, whereas beer is not. It's a different hazard level in terms of the containers of liquid and stuff. So,
right. So are you grinding fine then?
I'm not fermenting on grain at the moment. So everything that I'm making, I'm lautering.
Right.
So I'm literally making beer. And the Scotch and the Japanese, or Scottish and the Japanese, are both making whiskey that's lautered. So in my mind, for these initial experiments that I need to be able to produce and get out, I'm lautering and I'm making beer and I'm controlling fermentation in a way that I'm super familiar with. Right. Whereas fermenting on grain presents a whole bunch of new challenges in terms of fermentation, in particular, in that all the solids in the mash will pull the yeast out and you end up with lagged fermentations unless you've got the ability to agitate throughout the fermentation. So a lot of distillers, the guy who designed my still, who is another person who's been a huge resource to me, Rob Castle, from Philadelphia, all his fermenters have agitators. So they've got mixers, motor, you know, big 2 or 3 horsepower. And he's using small fermenters. So I think they're probably 10 barrel. And they're not conical. But they've got motors on that mounts on the top of them and with big mixers. And they're keeping the mash moving during the entire fermentation. And I've heard stories of what other people do. If they don't have agitators, is they'll set up recirculation of the mash during the entire fermentation through a pump,
sure.
Which sounds like a nightmare to me, because if you go home
and it gets clogged
and something backs up and you've got a pump on and pressure building in a fermentation, you come in and it's everywhere. It's just not, I'm not interested in that.
Right. But that's speeding up fermentation and keeping the yeast.
It's keeping yeast in suspension and making sure you get as much efficiency or yield out of your fermentation as possible in form of alcohol production.
Right.
So, cause that's what distillers are after, right? Is produce as much alcohol. And on some level, a lot of distillers are after the production of as much, phenolic and esters as they can too, right? Because all the compounds that you create during fermentation have vaporization points and can become compounds that are present in your distillate,
right?
Diacetyl, acetaldehyde, amyl acetate. And so if you can ferment hot and get your yeast to do a lot of that stuff, then if you're looking for a really complex profile, especially to put down in a barrel, then you can access all those compounds. But, you could also have sulfur production, and nobody wants sulfur. You know what I mean? So
you want a sulfury gin, for instance.
Yeah, well, you're still going to pull the sulfur out, hopefully, because that's the copper's there for.
But it's one less thing to
do. But still, it's going to reduce your efficiency on the yield, because you're going to get more tails and lots of sulfur.
Right.
So you have it. You made a gin so far, or at least that's available in
right.
the tap
room. Right. So I did a mash of barley and wheat. I think I used Czech pills and laudered it and fermented it with yeast that I got from other half, because that was the closest, most available yeast. Cause it was the very first thing that I did on the system once we got open.
Yeah.
Cause I figured we didn't know when we were actually going to sell at that point still, cause we had been approved by the state, but it was pending the Fed, and it was also pending submission of workers' comp insurance or something, some other thing that they won't give you a license unless you have. So I figured if I got something into a fermenter that I could then distill, it would give me more time to play around with the still, because I had never fired it up before. So I did a mash of barley and wheat and fermented it with the yeast and made, I think it was a 6 or 7% beer, and then ran. So the still is a third the capacity of the fermenters, so it's roughly 10 barrels. So I had to run all 30 barrels had to go through the still once in a stripping run. So it was three 10-barrel stripping runs, where I then yielded low wines, which are I got, imagine you get about 30% at about 40% alcohol, 25% alcohol. So I did 3 stripping runs on that beer, and then I had about 150 gallons of 25% alcohol, and then did a spirit run and yielded again about a 30% volumetric reduction with a much higher proof, around 75% alcohol, and then distilled that again with a bucket full of juniper and coriander and angelica root and licorice root.
So how did that work? Now you have 75% alcohol, and you basically turned it into an extract by letting it soak on.
Put it back into the still, cut it to 50% alcohol, because some of those botanicals have water soluble characteristics.
Gotcha.
And some of them have alcohol soluble characteristics. So you want, when people make gin, they usually cut to 50%.
Okay.
So if you were buying neutral grain spirit at 190 proof, 95% alcohol, you would then you'd almost double volumetrically what you charge the still with half your, you put the equal amount of water as alcohol in essentially, and then you'd put your botanical load in, and then you just redistill it. You run another complete, you vaporize all the alcohol off again in the presence of all the botanicals.
Does it matter the contact time on the botanicals?
I don't know.
Not sure yet.
There's people cool. who use gin baskets, and so that's like where you've got the column coming off the top of the or the head coming off the top of the still. Sometimes they'll have a almost like a hop back.
Sure.
So it's a basket where they can put the botanicals in, and that instead okay. of the. So what I made was like a macerated gin, right? Where the botanicals were actually in with the alcohol while it boiled. So that's a lot of contact, right? Sure. It was in there for, I mean, it was probably 6 hours, right? And it was just boiling. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to get certain things out of those botanicals in that case that you might not if you had it up in a basket on the side of the head and all that went through the botanicals was vapor.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. These are things that, yeah. you know.
Well, dude, it's a fun,
I'm gonna find out.
Fun adventure to get into,
yeah.
man.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought it was delicious.
Yeah, so. Thank you. I mean, it's a very grain-forward
yeah,
gin.
It's like a traditional Dutch gin.
Right, so we're calling it like a Jennifer.
Yeah.
yeah. Or a Dutch, or double Dutch. Like, Laura's found all these cool old, like, sort of old New Amsterdam-type documents about gin and... just the process and but yeah, double distillation was standard for American gin, you know, in the colonial period, because they were doing mashes and then following a mash up with a distillation with the botanical. So yeah, it's really grain forward. It's got a lot of compounds in it that, you know, aren't in vodka and aren't going to be in like your average sort of London dry or something.
So this is all really fun, and we can come taste these at your tasting room. Tell us about the space and what you envision for the tasting room. What are your hours? What are you serving there? Are you serving this gin, and what do you hope
yeah,
to have as far as diversity?
So the tasting room right now is open Thursday and Friday from 5 to 10, Saturday noon to 10, Sunday noon to 6. Right now, in terms of spirits, we have the one, we have the gin. We're serving it neat at 1 ounce pour or you know, gin and tonic that we were pouring on draft. We have 7 beers that I've brewed at the brewery at Innerboro, including Halftime and we only have 6 now because we poured through all the premier kegs.
Oh, those are delicious. But you can some of them.
I brought some cans.
So you're canning as well with that.
We canned premier. We're going to can again in October at some point. Another beer called The Next Episode. So that'll
yes.
be the next beer. Yeah, hold up, hey. and then I've got a Saison, which I brought tonight. I don't know if we're talking a lot. But Bring That Beat Back, which is a collaboration with Other Half, which we brewed at Innerboro.
And what hops are in that? Why is it named Bring That Beat Back?
Simcoe and Amarillo.
Bring That Beat Back. Bring
yeah,
it
old
back.
School.
Classic. Yeah,
yeah, and then Lottie Dottie is the session that has the old school Amarillo plus the new school Equinox.
Mm-hmm.
And that's 4.5%. And... Here Come the Drums, which is, I'm calling like an East Coast IPA, and it's kind of a throwback too, I think, in the sense that most people these days are making these juice bombs, these cloudy juice bombs, and Here Come the Drums is crystal clear, nice sort of amber color. And
somebody had reviewed something on Untappd today as unforgivably clear.
Right,
IPA.
Yeah, like you can suffer for that. You can suffer for that shit.
Oh, how things have turned in the last year or
Well, my joke is that, like, I spent 5 years at Carton trying to get boat clear.
Yeah.
And now
really?
2 years later, yeah. it, you know, 2 years later, like, it, you know, all people
Brewers
want
are adding flour to their beer.
Yeah. Hey,
Chet.
And so I'm pouring a beer at Innerboro that Greg Dorowski and I and Joel from Threes brewed, where we put 50 pounds of flour in.
Yep.
Sort of.
Just for
the tongue
lager.
In cheek.
It's a hoppy lager.
It's a Northeast style lager.
Yes.
Yeah.
I got to say, it's delicious. I had it at the brewery Brewery.
Delicious. I've been drinking a lot of it. I like it. It was Galaxy and Amarillo, so you can't really go wrong.
Cheater. Total cheater.
I've had some people tell me quit calling that corn lager a pills. I don't say who, but and I think that went through all the beers now. Oh, and then I have a collaboration with Transmitter, IB1, which is...
IB1 Kenobi.
What? and that's sort of like inspired by gin. That was something where we sat down and talked about, like what my process was going to be once we got open in Interborough and talking about trying to do collaborations with brewers that I could also then remake the mash into a distillate of and then play with. I mean, my whole goal is to sort of blur the lines as much as possible. So those guys, Rob and Anthony, of course, just like took that right up, and we ended that. It's a saison with star anise and elderflower, and then just like tons of grapefruit and lime and orange zest and citrus. Mm-hmm. And they fermented it, I think, at like 98 degrees or something ridiculous. it's super cool. It's super interesting beer. And then hopefully when they come and brew with me, we'll riff on that and make something. I don't know if we'll make a saison, but we'll make something with some cool botanicals, and then hopefully a gin that will also have some of the similar botanicals. So
awesome.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to playing with this, you know, the ingredients that go into a mash for a distillate and the ingredients that go into a mash for a beer, and then post fermentation, how we can back blend and barrel age, and you know, so recently I did a bunch of apple cider distillations, and I'm working on an apple brandy.
Because that's what those totes were, right?
They're from Indian Ladder Farmstead, Stuart and Dieter, and we actually have a beer we brewed together too, which is the next thing coming out of the tank. It's going to be like a harvest ale. It was all their hops, 50% their barley, 200 pounds of their oats, and then I think I have 44 or more pounds of they Nugget, Chinook, Cascade, and Centennial that they grew, and then we hop backed it through Whole Cone Centennial. Cool. Yes. And then we dry hopped it with Whole Cone Centennial that they grew. But so they gave me two totes, and I got two more totes of apple cider, hard apple cider, down from their cidery, and stripping runs on a couple of them, and gonna do a spirit run hopefully in a week or two, and then the goal being to put enough down in a barrel, in a whiskey barrel, to age for a year, and then have some available as new make apple brandy as a base for some cocktails, and then talking about blending stuff, then next year hopefully making some Pomo, which is barrel aged apple brandy blended back with fresh cider.
So about 17%.
So like a wine strength, more or less.
Yeah.
And I had some up at this great distillery that was right in Boston, or outside Boston, right around the corner from Night Shift, called Short Path Distilling, and they had a Pomo that was just incredible. And they barrel aged apple brandy is pretty awesome too. So
yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
I look forward to that next year.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. Cider I keep telling people about this project is it's going to be a lot of patience.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's a lot of long play.
But you can drink delicious beer until,
yeah,
you know,
exactly,
while,
at least you can make
while you're waiting for you.
Yeah. The other thing is, so the tasting room is right off the L train. It's like half a block from the Grand Street L train stop, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
A block?
The address is 942 Grand. It's a block and a couple of doors down
from
Bushwick and Grand, on the south side of the street.
Waterbury and Catherine, right?
Well, no, Waterbury. Catherine's across the street.
Catherine
and Waterbury, neither one of them cross Grand.
Okay.
So we're technically between Waterbury and Morgan.
Right, okay.
But Catherine is actually a little bit closer.
On the other
because
side
they
of
don't
confusing.
None of them
right
on the other side of the street, so it's 942 Grand Street,
right off the Grand L train.
Yeah,
yep. Cool.
It's a beautiful space.
Yeah,
I'm happy you're there.
It is walking distance from our apartment too, because I walked home that first time.
Really?
I went over. When you were chasing me from the tank, I walked home.
That means that it's probably walking distance from Roberta's.
Yes, definitely.
It's definitely walking.
I'm walking there right now.
Yeah. we're going to end up having food. We've got a small kitchen, so we're going to have food. And we have to do flights, which has been really popular for opening, because I've had a lot of people come in and order two flights. Oh, do we?
We're gonna wrap it up. We gotta wrap up. Oh, Pierre, our engineer's going. No,
I didn't mean it by that. That nod, that yawn.
Should we open another beer?
We should open another beer, but we do kind
but
of.
But on that note, we're
going
to go. We're going to open cans at the premiere. So you sold these cans only through the brewery, correct?
So far, yeah. So, we might sell some out into the market.
But you're a 30 barrel system, yep. Right? And you've got 30 barrel fermenters. Yep. You actually raised the ceiling so that you can actually yield a lot more going forward. So we can expect to over these years at the same time as waiting for these distillates. You will increase production, and we will have a lot of beer coming.
Yeah, a lot of beer. Yeah. Hopefully, we don't drink it all ourselves.
Yeah, it's
okay.
I cannot promise that.
Thanks so much. It's super exciting to see because since I've known you since
I know,
a homebrewer and to see this whole progression and. Yeah. I've been in Interbro 3 times.
This is not the first time we've heard your voice on Foment about it, actually. At CBC, in our first year around that drunken evening where we were doing interviews, I believe you helped us interview...
Matt Brindleson.
Oh, that's right.
I forgot about that. Yeah. That was
good times. Yeah, that was awesome.
Good times.
That's before I learned about sober interviewing skills.
I know. Mary was like, I got Matt Brindleson outside. I want to have some new brewer interview him. I was like, I'll interview that dude.
But you talked about kettle souring after Sandy, too, though.
Yeah, and then... Kettle sour. That was the other time
that was one of our first year.
Oh, both of them?
No, the yeah.
Both of them are in the same year. In the first year.
Yeah, awesome. we did a lot of kettle souring at Carton. I'm not sure I'm going to do a lot of kettle souring. I'm more interested in a barrel sour program at this point. But
cool. So where can they find Interbro? You have Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and
Interbro dot NYC is the website. Interbro NYC, InterboroNYC is the Instagram handle and the Twitter handle, and then Facebook is Interbro NYC. I don't really know how to find it on Facebook.
Search Interbro, Interboro.
Facebook/ something.
Yeah, I can never remember
just
that.
Just Google it. It's great.
Yeah.
The Google machine is your friend.
Yeah, and we're on draft like all over Brooklyn and Manhattan. We've been doing wholesale deliveries now for 5 weeks, I think. And the other half collaboration, Bring That Beat Back, is getting delivered to bars this week.
So. Fantastic.
Awesome.
Jesse, thanks, man.
Yeah, thank you guys.
Thank you so much
for letting me talk.
Foment about it.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Wall with no end on the banks of forgiveness.
You clutch to your burden. Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.